Welcome to Casterbus. My name is Christian Corley. His name is James McLean. You join us slap bang in the middle of the afternoon on a Friday, straight after recording the previous podcast. We do that sometimes. It makes life a lot easier if we can just double up with these things. So I'm not going to bother asking James how he is, because you can just refer back to the previous podcast.
Yeah.
And you can tell me then. And by this point, he's probably slightly more miserable than he was at the beginning of the last podcast.
Yeah, I'm feeling hungry now.
Okay, hangry alert. Do you know, just to go back to the last podcast, you and I wanted to talk to you about this at the time, but I was distracted.
20 minutes ago.
Yeah, 20 yes. minutes ago, yeah. I was distracted by the fact, because you were making such a strong point, it led me into another area. But you mentioned some sort of list or poll of actors and how people recognise them. Now, I was listening to a comedy/current affairs podcast earlier today, and a similar point was made concerning comedians and how there's no current comedians, like new comedians, who can be considered household names. Mm-hmm. And I found this quite interesting, that it's not just a thing in comedy, you know, but from what you said, it's something that's happening across the board.
But it's not surprising, though, is it? Because at one point, everyone in the UK was watching four channels and going to the same movies.
Yeah,
so there's a consolidation of people in view for people to get to know.
Yeah.
But now the stuff that a 20-year-old watches is absolutely divorced from what a 45-year-old watches.
Yeah.
So there's no way that any of this stuff is going to carry. Everything is being disseminated across. It's dissolved. And so you've got none of those meeting points where that was the point. You know, someone who was 20, as we said before, someone was 20, someone who was 50 would know who Steve McQueen was.
Yeah.
Or they would, you know, let's go into the UK. They would know who the two Ronnies were.
Yeah.
You know, everyone would sit down on Saturday and they would watch that pair.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not surprising to me at all. It's interesting, but it's not surprising.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the similar point was made, like if you ask comedians, I think the point was made, if you ask comedians, then Dave Chappelle's the biggest comedian in the world. Now, I've heard of Dave Chappelle. I'm not sure if I've ever seen Dave Chappelle, but I know for a fact that most of the people that I know have no idea who Dave Chappelle is. Maybe like, and when I say most of the people I know, I'm bringing older family members in and all that. I would say half of them at least don't know who Dave Chappelle is, whereas everyone knows who Ricky Gervais is in that group of people. Whereas, you know, like 20 years ago, I mean, everyone knows who Steve Martin is. Everyone knows who any number of comedians are 20 years ago, but not so much these days.
Well, in fairness, Dave Chappelle is actually a pretty big name.
I've heard of him, but I'm not entirely sure if I've seen him.
Your friends. Okay.
Is he the one who was in trouble a few years ago for saying something?
He's had a few.
So I definitely know Netflix, who he is, but again, I don't know if I've ever listened to it. I was watching a clip of Comfortable, old Des O'Connor with Bob Monkhouse on Des O'Connor Tonight from, I would say, 1995. And it was a very nice and amusing and inoffensive selection of jokes. I raise this for no other reason that these are both household names in the UK and... Bob Monkhouse, very, very funny. Absolutely. I mean, he was a very good comedian throughout his career, but I think as he came towards his final years, I think he got even better somehow, certainly in his delivery or timing or something. I don't know what it was. It was just so nice to watch and feel, you know, those sort of nostalgia vibes that we get from watching old TV shows and clips that we might have watched at the time.
I was going to say, is that like... a nostalgia thing, or is it something that you time would have?
Because there's that whole thing that Des O'Connor, that whole thing with Bob Monkhouse is like, but I mean, when I watch an old comedy, when I'm watching any comedy, if it's comedy that's making me laugh, then I consider it to be comedy. And then sort of, there's a part of my brain that's kind of trying to analyze how it's working. And if that's something that I can, you know, replicate in some way for whatever I'm writing. So if I'm watching someone like Bob Monkhouse and I want to, I'm very much paying attention to the jokes, because I want to know, not just, I don't just want to laugh. I also want to know why I'm laughing and how that joke is working. So that's a lot of the reason why I watch old comedy in particular, rather than, like, I know people do. I mean, I'll find Gareth watches old episodes of Coronation Street, doesn't he? Which isn't something that I do. Even though I think he prefers those sort of that period of the 70s that were rather sort of lighthearted and had a bit of comedy in them anyway. But that isn't something I, or any old dramas really, other than, you know, the things that we talk about on this podcast.
Well, I think there's an interesting thing. I don't think it's just nostalgia. And again, I don't know if it's an age group thing as well. It could be an age group. But I think there has been... For a long time now, certainly in the last 20 years, 25 years, maybe 30, that lack of sense of light drama. So you could see a little of it in Coronation Street. You could see it. I know you love the show. I abhor it, but Last the Summer Wine, or certainly later seasons, I abhor, where there's a very sort of gentle flow of events that aren't. I've been watching Ted Lasso on Apple. Okay. And again, there's a little bit of that to that as well. Everyone is actually kind of nice, bar a couple of people. There's not any massive drama points. We don't have that. All Creatures Growing Small, I suppose, has replicated a bit of that in its recent incarnation. Yep. And those feel like throwbacks to me to that period, as you say, what Gareth likes, where there wasn't a sense of need to, or yet there wasn't that sort of pressure to sort of do big things to keep people watching, which EastEnders, I think, was kind of in the UK, one of the ones that kickstarted it. Yeah. Coronation Street was kind of still quite gentle. EastEnders comes in with some, you know, big hitting storylines, which was starting, and audiences started to migrate over. And you saw suddenly that was the same for Coronation Street. And I can understand why Gareth kind of likes era before there was that pressure for audiences that sort of started really badly in the 80s, where it started to really become quite... stressed.
Yeah.
To keep people. But are they good? I don't know. I'm always worried about nostalgia. I'm always a bit, I mean, it's that whole thing, as we've said before, in the 80s, where there was this sort of kind of ideology, 70s, 80s, nothing had to be really good. It just had to be a little less shit than what was on the other channel.
Yes.
So the quality markers were different to how they are now. And I know people say, well, the stuff was really high quality then. And go, yeah, but you look at the complexity, and even if you don't like it for whatever reason, shows these days are often quite deep. They're quite, the production is very, very, very good.
Yeah.
It's a different beast. And there's a lot of stuff back then which was kind of, but it was seemed good because everything else was more. I mean, I never found, I mean, Bob Monkhouse is someone who I think I always admired for his ability to memorize and kind of riff out jokes when he needed to. The jokes I found largely terrible and I didn't like them, but I admired that ability to perform a certain sort of material which appealed to people who weren't me. And that's fine, because I'm not saying my humor is better than other people's, but that skill of that craft was impressive. But the shows were fairly, you know, innocuous. I think the only one I think back to the sort of Gareth Cavanagh era of television, which I was thinking like Blankety Blank, I think had quite a, I remember at the time, an edge to it, which other shows didn't have. Well, today,
I like how we call this the Gareth Cavanagh era of television.
Well, I mean, people who have listened to this will know who we mean.
Blankety Blank's a very good example, I think.
But I think if that was out now, I don't think it would stand up, because what it was doing then was kind of utilized in greater ways by things like Shooting Stars, the run of quiz shows, whether we're talking of Mind the Buzzcocks, Have I Got News for You, where suddenly the points didn't matter essentially. And it was really about the characters and having Kenny Everett on the front row or Les Dawson playing off Terry Wogan or then later Lily Savage. Those were the sort of things which stood out because everything else was kind of rubbish. But now we see so much of that. I think Blankety Blank, and I know it has come out since, but I don't think it would carry that that same
power. Well, you've stumbled. You've reminded me of something quite interesting about Blankety Blank. There is that when I was watching the do you recall the Blankety Blank with Peter Serafinowicz that was done for Comic Relief, where Peter Serafinowicz is playing Terry Wogan, Martin Freeman's playing Sid Vicious. No, he's not. He's playing Johnny Rotten. Beg your pardon. Sarah Alexander's playing Liza Goddard. A couple of, I think Simon Pegg's in there as well, and Nick Frost is playing Willie Rushton as a giant walrus. But I'll get to the point, is that it's a very, very clever kind of reflection of Blankety Blank. But if you actually watch old episodes of Blankety Blank with Terry Wogan on YouTube, which I have done occasionally, you know, there's sketches that, like that one of Serafinowicz's, it's very, very good, and it kind of subverts Blankety Blank. But Terry Wogan was already quite subversive with Blankety Blank. He was already kind of like mocking the format, much as he would do with his radio show later on. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Blankety Blank, the Blankety Blank checkbook and pen, which was the prize, again, itself is a sort of commentary, isn't it? That, you know, a prize would be a lot of money, and they're giving you a sort of silver checkbook and pen.
Yeah.
Yeah, which at the time I didn't get the joke there, but you know, as an adult now, I didn't get the innuendo, which I think is pretty rubbish now, but at the time was there. But I don't think really pushed the show forward. What you were watching it for was, as you say, that it kind of was a meta, almost like a postmodern take on the game show, which again get to the 90s and you get Chris Evans started, a slew of shows, the Toothbrush one, so Don't Forget Your Toothbrush, which again attacked that format, and Julian Clary was doing it as well.
Yeah.
But Blankety Blank was the first kind of mainstream one to start like mocking that approach. And also, I thought what was very clever about it in its design is that it deliberately trivialized the contestants. The actual public who came on were utterly disposable. They came on, it was all about the TV personalities. And, you know, there was almost a deliberate humiliation in the way that when they lost, that where the contestant sat would slowly revolve around, and they'd have to wave as they disappeared behind the set. You know, it's a really smart thing. But then you've got things now like Taskmaster, which is not to say Taskmaster is better, because it's been built on those building blocks.
Yeah.
But all the things which kind of made Blankety Blank clever, the sort of play on celebrities, the riff on the game show, the strong personalities of those leading that show, you know, Taskmaster does in a far more sophisticated way.
I have an issue with Taskmaster. I was invited to... what was it? Was it assess, evaluate, or review? I don't think it was a straight review. So I was asked to review an episode of Taskmaster, probably series 2 or 3. So it was a while ago. And it was the first episode. So I started, and I'd never watched it at this point, and I haven't watched it since, because I found it to be very contrived. And I'd been given the impression, and maybe this is part of the reason, that it was very, very funny and amusing, and all these famous comedians got dropped into very silly situations that they had to, find a solution to get out of, and it was very, very funny. I didn't laugh once. I just found it I felt as though it was heavily scripted, which it probably shouldn't be, because, and certainly shouldn't have, but it shouldn't be heavily scripted show, because I don't think it is a scripted show, but it felt that
scripted,
way. No, exactly. But it felt that way. It felt like everyone was trying too hard not to complete the challenge, but to stumble on some sort of seam of comedy. And that irritated me.
That's interesting. And again, it's also, comedy is more subjective than pretty much anything else, drama or whatever. It depends on what lands for you. And there's been times, when I first watched Taskmaster, I just didn't have the time for it. And then I went back and have very much enjoyed it. There's been a couple of seasons which I just couldn't get through because I didn't like the personalities, the characters who are on there. And often I think Taskmaster works when it brings in sort of young, new faces. But when it brings in old, stable, old familiar faces, somehow it doesn't quite work. I found... no offense, I'm sure he's a lovely guy. I found Steve Pemberton when he did it recently. It didn't feel like it really worked for him. He felt very competitive. He didn't have that sort of energy, which I think the show wanted. And I found that that set of contestants a lot harder. So I think it does depend on who you've got in there. And again, as you say, what your own tastes are. You know, if you, some people love Sue Perkins, some people don't. Some people love Frankie Boyle, some people don't. Some people love Lucy Beaumont, some people don't. And if you don't like, if you don't vibe with those set, or at least two thirds of that set, it becomes very hard to watch that show. Because it is all about personality. So it is a really interesting show. And it was the same with Blankety Blank, though. For me, as a kid, if Kenny Everett wasn't on it, wasn't that interested. To me, Kenny Everett was, and again, because it was, he was the one who was working with Wogan to break format. He was the one who would bend Wogan's mic, which, you know, you never saw on TV, that sort of defiance of format. And that became something. But now, that wouldn't blow you away.
No.
So it's a time of, it's, there's, I suppose what the Gareth Cavanna era is a sort of more innocent time. It's not to say it's better or worse, but the, what sort of the makeup of it is a time where everything was a lot less sophisticated, and not in a, not, I don't mean that in a sort of derivative way, but it didn't have the back catalogue of experiences to draw upon that, say, like it or not, something like Taskmaster has.
Yeah.
It had a far smaller amount to build on. So it was a far more artisan era, I guess, for the BBC in light entertainment. And you've got to sort of respect that, I think, to some degree.
Yeah, I think all entertainment as well is really constrained by formats and media, isn't it, really? And as the world has developed, we've got, say, we've got more channels, we've got more media, more mediums. So
what interests me, have you watched Ted Lasso at all?
I may have seen a trailer for it, but that's about it.
Ted Lasso is interesting because just thinking about the format, because it's a sitcom, obviously. Right. Well, it's not obviously if you don't know. It's about basically, it's based on a set of sort of adverts that NBC was doing to sort of sell football to America. Right. And it was basically, the joke was in a bit of a Parks and Rec way that Ted Lasso was this very sort of Midwestern American coach who is now coaching Tottenham Hotspur. Okay. And that was the gag, that he just didn't get British football.
Yeah.
That was the way they were trying to sell it. And then in about 2018 or so, well, I think 2020 is when it aired, Apple, they produced a show based on this format with Bill Lawrence, who did Scrubs, as one of the key producers, writers, alongside Jason Sudeikis, who was the who is Ted Lasso. But what was interesting, I found in the first season, was there were some really interesting attempts to break those sitcom formats in a way that I hadn't seen before. So, like, there was an episode where there's two established female characters who are starting to get on well, and then the third female character comes in, who is a close friend of one of them, who is really popular and powerful. And you're starting, I can see where this is going to go. So one of the female characters who's not the friend of the other is going to start feeling isolated. There's going to be pushback, and it's going to end with a big resolve, a blowout and resolve. And it did none of that. And it seemed to keep doing that, create sort of almost like it was aware of these conventions that we would expect, set them up, and then just take it in a totally different direction.
Right.
And that to me was really refreshing. The third season hasn't done that at all, and it's been a bit disappointing because you see the markers and you go, oh, I can see what's going to happen here. That person's going to get with this person eventually. But you couldn't do that in the first two seasons. Right. And it just reminded me that even in things like the sitcom, there is still space for change. There is still space to take things in different directions. And there could be another era where, you know, where sitcoms could come back in and do things where they're not still looking back at Friends as the, you know, the template.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the news that Mrs. Brown's Boys has got another series would seem to indicate we're probably quite some time away from that happening. We were going to talk about a particular thing. I think we're probably going to run out of time for doing that. So I want
Doctor Who.
Yeah, save that for another time. Because we're talking about nostalgia, and do you remember at the beginning before we started recording the last podcast, I was wavering. I asked you if you could see this.
Oh yes, yeah.
So I've got a BBC Micro Model B, which we used to use at school as a kid, and this power supply has been running for, well, I mean, I don't know how much it ran before I got hold of it. It certainly ran occasionally for the past couple of years without any problem, but then it popped. So I'm going to have to repair that. And that's repairable without needing special skills beyond soldering, because it's such a basic power supply and circuit board. But earlier today, I was playing a demo of a game called Project X Light Years. Do you remember Project X on the Amiga?
I don't. Project X.
Yeah, it was on the 1200 and 4000. So it was like a later one. It needed the AGA graphics, I think. It was a side scroller. You would shoot something, you would pick up a power up, and then you could either gather up power ups to like upgrade your speed or your guns or whatever as you kept going, or you could just upgrade something very quickly and then collect some more up. So you had a strategy that you had to follow, or you had to build your strategy as you played through each level, what you're going to pick up and what you were going to power up as you were shooting. And there's a demo version. I think the company that produced it was called Team 17, and the guys involved passed away, I think, last year. So this is kind of like a tribute version for PC. And I was playing the demo for it. And aside from, I mean, the soundtrack, the graphics, in terms of like the ethos of the graphics, the depth and the scrolling, you know, the HUD is been upgraded, but the audio and the, it's all there. So it's like the same game, but just like everything that needed to be upgraded to the modern sensibility has been upgraded to that. And it got me thinking, there's a lot of old games that are being remastered and re-released and stuff. And, you know, we were talking about old TV and the Gareth Cavanagh era of television. But I think there's, I sent something to Gareth earlier today, actually, funnily enough. It was it was a video game that someone's developing for the ZX Spectrum, of all things, based on Ulysses 31, which is like, that's prime Cavanagh stuff. But the point being, and obviously I have a retro gaming site, so I'm kind of tapped into this sort of stuff, but there's a lot more retro gaming games, like retro-based games, games for old platforms that you can't buy anymore or that you can buy a little version of, coming out. There's a new, the game Settlers has been, a new version of Settlers has been, is coming out on the Amiga. There's a new version of the Amiga coming out. Gamescom is on at the moment. This is like the Europe's biggest games industry event. And most of the first week, you've had AAA releases accompanied by news of new retro gaming systems. This is absolutely unheard of. So to wind this back to what we were saying about, or what you were saying, about there being just like three channels or four channels some years ago, there was just a handful of video game platforms. Those are just a handful of radio stations and music formats. And now we can just, there was a thing, wasn't there, when we were getting satellite television and cable television in the late 80s, early 90s, and people were concerned about the quality of these other channels, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, maybe with things like Heil, Honey, I'm Home, maybe they had a point. But this fracture isn't a recent thing, is it? It started at a particular point, I'm going to say the late 80s, early 90s. And as more formats have come along and more media and mediums have come along, so everything's kind of fractured, and everything where we used to have like subcultures that were very much underground, subcultures aren't so much underground anymore. There's just a, for want of a better word, they're part of a spectrum of a culture. Well, they're very kind of like walled off. I'm going to stop talking now so you can say something.
Do you think the retro market, by its very name, I mean, I don't think it's entirely true across, but is it for those who it is retro? Do you think people who don't come from that era would get something out of like a Spectrum game or an Amiga game?
If it wasn't for YouTube, I would say no, it's purely for people of our age. But I've seen YouTubers who are like in their 20s doing retro gaming stuff, and they've got big followings. So it's certainly not exclusively for older audiences, no. But again, I mean, it doesn't just have to be about gaming. I mean, you've got the whole thing with music. You got these, a friend and I were talking about music the other day, and then he sent me a link of George Harrison from the late 90s talking about the Beatles, and being slightly disparaging about the Beatles, as he often was. But the interview did get him to concede that it was at least better than a lot of contemporary music. And, I mean, yeah, that's another matter entirely. But we have all these different music genres that once upon a time you could maybe draw a line through and, you know, hook them together. Whereas now it's a little more difficult to do that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the thing with music's interesting because you'll have 18-year-olds with Nirvana T-shirts.
Yeah.
And you think, if I was that age, like I was when Nirvana was out, what I would have to be wearing to have that same sort of time zone but still have the same cachet as being edgy.
Roy Orbison.
Well, this is what I mean. So that's an interesting thing. And again, I don't disagree with you on the retro argument because, I mean, like my sister at the moment, and I have as well, played Stardew Valley, which plays itself on a very retro 16-bit style. And as you've intimated as well, certainly AAA is in a bit of trouble for the same way that, as we've talked about in the previous podcast, Disney and the like are, because they cost a lot of money to run these games, and it's harder to make the returns that they're expecting. While people are gravitating towards smaller games, and certainly another thing they're gravitating towards in terms of, like, there's a bit of a taste culture thing here, which I think is also a bit of a, if I dare say, a fuck you to the AAA, is where they find games, and we've talked about this before, things like No Man's Sky, or even to a certain degree things like Baldur's Gate with Larian Studios, how they're producing high quality stuff on smaller teams and then sort of turning around to the big companies and going, but your stuff is terrible. Yep. Now, my disagreement there is a lot of the bigger games, I suppose, again, coming from the same era as you and knowing what games used to be like, the big hatred of Dragon Age game that came out last year or so, I've played and I think it's brilliant. It's bugless. It's, for me anyway, it's smart. It's not as good as the other three Dragon game for me, but it's not this awful game.
Yeah.
And I think part of the dislike of that game is this cultural awareness. It comes from a company which has low value within the gaming within gamers. So automatically it's on a bit of a back foot to really prove itself more so than than one that, say, is it Helios Games who do New Man's Sky, whatever, with what they produce, because people are aware of the difference. So I think there's some really interesting things going on, but whatever the reasons are, like you say, I think there's a simplicity to retro games which people enjoy, and I think maybe also a response to saturated market of media content. People sometimes quite like something simple which they can play for a bit and put down without feeling like they got like 80 hours of narrative gameplay to invest in.
Yeah,
I'm like that. I got Red Dead Redemption 2 very late last year, earlier this year, and I played a bit of it, and I just can't bring myself to invest in the gameplay, in the story world. I'm not overly keen on skinning animals, just don't like it, and especially when it's done in quite graphical.
It is a bit.
And I think you're right. There's a certain sort of simplicity to retro games, which just kind of appeals to a world which is just so suffocated with things to do that sometimes you just want to kick back and play something straightforward and simple, sideways scroller.
Yeah.
Which again is interesting because when we used to play them as kids, they were the top end often of the market.
Yeah,
and now it's almost like it's the opposite way around, which makes them appealing.
I was looking at a game a couple of days ago called Arch Rebel Tactics, which is a sort of a thematic sequel to Rebel Star, which came out on the ZX Spectrum almost 40 years ago. And just to sort of like add to like the tactical cachet of this, it's been published by the revived Microprose company. So, you know, there's a lot of this stuff about, but what you just, going back to your AAA thing and riffing back on what we were talking about in our last podcast together, this whole idea of the AAA games, we've got an industry of AAA games, basically. If we like there's like a two-tier gaming industry, almost like there's a two-tier cinema industry in some ways. Everything is being, you know, like every publisher is like avoiding publishing a game to accidentally coincide, they don't want to release the same month as the next Grand Theft Auto.
No. Yes, they're that's absolutely been a funny petrified thing, hasn't it?
About it. Yeah, yeah. And like Rockstar Games keeps putting it back, and it's the same with Hollywood movies, isn't it? A big movie scheduled, all the other movies want to avoid it. If you're listening on Patreon, the next section of the podcast features a discussion on disappearing media and nostalgia for old eras of Doctor Who. If you're not listening on the Patreon, it's the end of the show. So if anyone listening has any thoughts on that, because I do want to talk about that in more in-depth in future episodes, I'm going to wrap things up now. I just want to tell everyone, James, how long is it you've been living in Yorkshire now?
I don't know, a few years. Why?
How many years?
Three.
3 years. He's done very well, hasn't he, ladies and gentlemen, in not picking up any sense of an accent. Let me tell you, that is really difficult.
I'm careful now. I'm careful what I say.
I wish him the best of luck with that. My dad has lived here for 53 years and still has no accents.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, it still sounds like he's from Kent. Yeah. There you go. Anyway, so thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. And this is coming to you on Patreon first, as you know, in video format. If you're not watching this in video format, get on the Patreon, and then you can see us talking to each other, and you can see James berating me with his drumstick or his sonic screwdriver or whatever it is this week. We'll be back for another podcast soon. Until then, it's goodbye from us.